Good day, everyone. This is Tim Hooks on behalf of the International Legal Technology Association with another podcast. And today we have again with us Larry Kuhn from Microsoft. Larry, you want to take a minute and introduce yourself?
Good day, Tim. Good day, audience. Larry Kuhn from Microsoft, account technology strategist working in the Chicago area and vendor liaison to ILTA. Happy to be here.
Thanks a lot for being with us. And I also work for American Municipal Power in Columbus, Ohio as their IT director and participate in ILTA's volunteer. So today we're going to talk about Exchange Online and again on the series with Office 365. I know from an administrative perspective there's a lot of benefits for us, but what about, before we get into all that, tell us a little bit about what's in it for the end users and why they might be interested in a company making a move like this.
Well, sure. From the end user perspective, you know, a lot of organizations out there are running Exchange 2010 or Exchange 2013 on premises with, you know, a little bit of an aged functionality experience at this point. So that from the end user's perspective, if an organization were to make a move to Exchange Online, they get the benefit of having, you know, the modern Exchange infrastructure that Microsoft is keeping always up to date on the back end. So there are a few specific benefits that will surface to end users as a result of that, things that they may not have if they're on-premise environment. So the first one is the service capability around the size of the mailbox. So Exchange Online mailboxes are 50 gigabytes per user. That, in my experience, is much larger than what most organizations offer in an on-premise model. And each user also gets an unlimited size archive. So what that means is that the organization can get a lot of productivity back by eliminating the need for end users to spend time clearing out and deleting old mails. You can naturally, you know, from the administrator's standpoint, put in place item retention policy so that things are automatically aged off, deleted, or moved to the archive. But the end user is not going to run into that limitation of hitting a full mailbox anytime soon. The next one is anywhere access. So at this day and age, most organizations have gone through the effort to put in edge servers to expose their exchange infrastructure externally so that mobile clients and roaming users have access to mailboxes. But that's not true universally. So, you know, that might be a new benefit for some organizations, that all the mobile clients will light up and work because being a cloud-based service, Exchange Online is accessible anywhere. Recently, we added the concept of what are called modern attachments. So this is where you have the ability, if you're using the Outlook web access or Outlook web app, as it's now called, user interface in a web browser, you have the ability to open and view attachments right inside the web browser. You don't have to download those to the local workstation or fire up a copy of any of the Office applications. You can work with them right within the browser. And say if you were to receive an email attachment, working together with OneDrive for Business, you'd be able to, in the browser, save that file directly into your OneDrive for Business cloud-based storage without having to round trip it as a download to the local workstation. So that's pretty nice. And then the last feature, which we just lit up a few weeks ago across the entire service, is the concept of the clutter folder. So Exchange Online is automatically monitoring your behavior in your inbox, and we can notice newsletters or low priority mail that you may not read or read on a very infrequent basis, and we'll automatically sweep those items out of your inbox into the clutter folder to kind of get them out of the way so that your most critical and important business correspondence stays easily accessible in your inbox. So that's a pretty handy feature, something that I've been really getting a lot of benefit from because I'm subscribed to a lot of newsletters, you know, things that are non-time sensitive that I get around to when I get around to. So I just make a point to visit my clutter folder once in a while and see what's in there, but keeps them out of my way when I'm trying to get work done during the week.
That sounds great. Was that product built off of an acquisition Microsoft made, or did they spin that up from scratch?
Clutter is actually an in-house developed capability. It uses machine learning on the back end. So we feed the usage data into our machine learning engine in Azure in order to help us understand which items should be categorized as clutter.
I've heard of other products that handle that in different ways, and so that's why I wondered if it was an acquisition, but that's great.
You maybe think about the difference on the mobile clients. On iOS and Android, we have this concept of the focused inbox. So that uses a little bit different mechanism, but it's a similar concept. So that filters less urgent items out of the inbox on the mobile client.
Well, let me see a couple other questions before we get more into the administrative stuff that are a little more on the user side. The first one I want to ask you about is signatures. You know, one of the things I understood early on with Office 365 is that I couldn't use like a third-party signature email disclaimer type thing because I didn't have Exchange in-house and that was typically installed on the Exchange server. I understand that's different. That's changing. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Yes, that definitely has changed. Let me just kind of like recap all the different ways that you can work with signatures in Office 365. So first and foremost, you have the user-administered approach where you can configure a signature block using the Outlook client. That's always worked with Exchange Online. We've always had that capability. The other thing that we've had for a long time is the ability to use transport rules. There's a transport rule capability that where you can manipulate disclaimer text, and some people have used that in order to, in addition to putting disclaimer text into the body of an email, they'll also put a signature block. And that has some limitations, but that capability has been there for a while with Exchange Online. Over time, the vendors and the third-party vendors in the market who have specialized products around providing organizationally consistent and structured signature blocks, they've enhanced and remodeled their products to work with the Exchange Web Services interface, which is available in Exchange Online, so that their products now do integrate with Exchange Online through the Exchange Web Services. So they're able to provide their product capability in there. So I'm just kind of skipping here through my notes to take a look at a couple of the vendors that I noticed. So there's Exclaimer. I think they're probably one of the larger vendors in the marketplace. They had an announcement back in March of 2015 that their product does indeed work with Office 365, and then there's another vendor out there, Code2, that I noticed has a product, and there may be some other ones as well. The APIs that they're using are publicly accessible and well documented, so other vendors are welcome as well to modify their products to work with Office 365. So if you've got an existing vendor that you're using for email signatures, that's not one of those two. Certainly approach them and express your interest, and they should be able to work with you to enhance their product.
Okay, that's all good news. I know Exclaimer seems to be, I hear a lot about them in ILTA, although I think a lot of
folks. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I think a lot of folks in this community use their product.
Well, sort of get down to the nuts and bolts behind the scenes. Sort of relates to users, but if you have an Exchange server in-house, it's pretty clear on how to handle mailbox restores and how to get people's email back and those sorts of things. How is that in the online version? Is it still pretty accessible for an administrator?
Yeah, it definitely is. I'll kind of work from the end user's perspective back through to the administrator. So the end user, they can do deleted item recoveries in the same way that they do today with their on-premise system. So when you delete an item, it moves to deleted folder, and they can leave it in the deleted folder as long as they want, and then the administrator can configure what the expiration time is for items in the deleted folder. So by default that's 30 days. So a user can just drag it back to their inbox if it's within those 30 days and they haven't emptied their deleted items folder. Now if they did go ahead and in Outlook empty out the deleted items folder. Then there's a folder that's accessible to the administrator on the back end called the recoverable items folder. By default, that's configured to hold items for 14 days. You know, with help of an administrator, you can always get an accidentally deleted item back out of the recoverable items folder. And then at the individual mail level, you've got single item recovery as an option. So you can set essentially it's a rolling legal hold, say for, you know, 120 days or something like that. You don't want any items deleted. So that'll hold them in the recoverable items folder and you'll be able to get them back. And then the aggregate mailbox level, if the administrator deletes a mailbox, user leaves the organization or something like that, delete the mailbox, then you decide later you need to get it back. Those are kept around for 30 days. You can always recover a mailbox back to its full original state within those 30 days. So all of those options are available. Other options that come into play here in terms of giving you a safety net in your organization is that you can definitely use mailbox export as a tactic if it's necessary in your environment. You could export mailboxes to a PST file and then store those in, you know, some other storage location. You could put them in Azure storage. You could bring them back and store them on premises if you needed to for safety purposes. And then if in the event all those other recovery mechanisms I talked about were expired and you had that on outside of backup, you can always import that back into Exchange Online and then recover items out of there.
Sort of while we're on this topic, can you talk a little bit about the legal hold capabilities available in like an E3 agreement? Full confession here, I'm an Office 365 user and I came into an organization that already had Exchange Online. And it's worked great for us. And from my perspective as an administrator, it's great. I mean, it's just one less thing to worry about. And we do use the legal hold feature. And if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, that would be I think that's good information to have, too, because when you try to do that in-house, that's a lot of expense, with regards to keeping tapes or backups of some sort, particularly when the legal holds get extended. So
our strategy and approach with Exchange Online is to make things really simple there. And so the key simplifying element is that conceptually legal hold happens in place. So there are a couple different levels at which you can preserve items. You could set a legal hold on an entire mailbox and, you know, hold everything in that mailbox, or you can set filters. You could create queries and say, I need to hold anything that was sent to or from specific recipient or anything that contains specific keywords. And for each one of those holds, you can have different hold periods. But all of that takes place inside its original storage location. So you're not having to gather, extract, and move those items. You just mark them as held. And so an individual piece of mail might wind up being subject to several different hold conditions. And we'll keep that piece of mail until the last of those hold conditions is removed. Items that are on hold don't count against the mailbox quota, so you don't have to worry about that. So it really makes it very simple and easy to take care of complying with legal hold requests.
And if the legal hold moves to the next step, that is, you know, some sort of collection is required, can an administrator just as easily go and search across whatever's subject to the hold for keywords or recipients and that kind of thing and produce them or collect them and turn them over to legal counsel just as easily?
Yes, absolutely. So there's a concept within the online administration center called the compliance center. And within the compliance center, you have the ability to go ahead and execute collection activities, and we'll extract all the items that meet a criteria from a hold set into PSTs. So we preserve the original format of the messages and package those up, and then you can take that collected material and move it into a review system if that's what you'd like to do. So all of that is built in native capability of Exchange Online.
Great. Well, that's also very handy. But, and I think we talked about this a little bit on our licensing conversation, the legal hold capabilities, that's not necessarily available with every package in the Exchange Online. It's available at like E3 and above. Is that accurate?
The ability to access the compliance center and execute the hold configurations and export collected items, that does require E3 or E4, but you can target mailboxes that are licensed under the lesser licenses. So you have to have, at least your administrators have to have that higher license.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's talk about, you know, if a firm were really looking at doing this, you know, one of the questions that comes up pretty early on is, how is it going to work with my document management system? You know, how is it going to work with other add-ins we might already have? For example, any of the things that add on to Outlook. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
The key thing when thinking about add-ins is to identify and separate between add-ins that are what I'll call purely client-side add-ins and those that have a Exchange Server integration component with them. So, you know, a pure client-side add-in is something that is manipulating the content of an email message by using the facilities that are available in the Outlook client. Those things are going to go ahead and keep working exactly the same way as they do today. So the COM add-in API model for Outlook has been unchanged since Outlook 2010. So any add-ins that work with 2010 should continue to work, you know, with Outlook 2013, and we'll continue to work with Outlook 2016, which is coming down the pipe pretty soon here in the fall or next spring. So you don't have to worry about the client side only, guys. Now, the ones where there's a little bit to pay more attention to are those where the add-in is sending a command to a server-side component that the vendor supplies that then interacts with the Exchange server. Older versions of iManage, for instance, those in 8.5X and earlier, are an example like this. So there was a client-side add-in component. It used to talk to a back-end component of iManage, and then that back-end component would talk to the Exchange server using an outdated and now deprecated extensibility model that we called server-side MAPI. And that integration model is not available for Exchange Online. So what the third-party vendors needed to do is, you know, similar to what we talked about before when we were talking about email signatures, they needed to modernize the integration facilities that they were using. And so many of the vendors have done that now. So iManage 9X and newer, I believe it is, does this, as well as, you know, several other vendors in the marketplace. They've modernized their server-side components, and they can talk to Exchange Online using the Exchange Web Access or Exchange Web Services APIs. And, you know, then they're able to kind of restore or continue to provide the functionality that they've had in the past. So that's something you'll need to check with each one of your third-party vendors about. But if you know, can at least do the first step of identifying which are client-side only versus which have a back-end server integration component, that'll help simplify, you know, your effort in terms of which ones you need to worry about and, you know, how many vendors you need to track down to talk to about that.
Well, that's good. So it sounds like as long as you have a relatively modern app, it ought to work.
That's definitely the hope, yeah, but you can't assume that. You know, you should definitely plan time in your project life cycle to reach out to each of those vendors and have a detailed accounting of what's in your environment.
So it looks like we're going to have to replace WordPerfect, too. Okay, so, you know, one of the things about this, you know, now that we, let's say, for example, determine that it'll work in our environment, you know, before I can get on to the benefits for me personally, which is a lot less work, I got to sell management on it. And one of the biggest questions I think that comes out of law firms in general, and maybe other companies as well, but when you talk about moving stuff to the cloud, there's a lot of concerns around security. I was lucky enough to sit through a very good presentation about security and particularly email and how it gets encrypted and stored in different places and so on and so forth. Can you briefly tell us about how data gets stored in the cloud with regards particularly to Office to Exchange Online?
Sure. So the first and most important summary points are that Exchange Online is a fully encrypted service in Microsoft's data center. So data is encrypted at rest, and it's encrypted in transit. And when we say it's encrypted at transit, it's encrypted between not only your end-user client, Outlook clients, and the Exchange server, but then it's also encrypted in transit as it moves between different servers within our data center. So you don't have to be concerned about any of those places. When we're running Exchange 2013 and newer versions of the Exchange server in our data centers, we're using the same types of mechanisms, you know, database availability groups and so forth that you would encounter if you were running Exchange infrastructure on premises. But we're running that on top of our data center storage fabric. So the data center storage fabric is responsible for taking any of these pieces of data, you know, individual messages, they wind up hitting the storage fabric as encrypted blocks, and then those blocks are distributed across a mesh of storage devices. So, you know, an individual email message might wind up being chopped up into blocks and stored across several different physical drives in a large, you know, rack of storage devices in our data center. So the data is really, you know, distributed across these physical devices. So that provides a layer of security right there. If anybody were to penetrate the physical security of the building, violate all of the practices and standards that we have in place to manage personnel access to the physical devices and, you know, somehow manage to get a live working device with data on there out of one of those racks, it would be completely useless to them because the keys for decrypting that data are not stored on that drive. They're stored separately in a key vault. And all of the blocks on that drive are individually encrypted blocks comprising several individual separate, you know, end user pieces of mail. So you wouldn't have all of the pieces on a single drive to reassemble any of those pieces of mail. So, you know, there's a lot of layers of physical security that come into play. And then from a logical security standpoint, of course, each one of our Office 365 tenants is a separate security boundary managed by Active Directory, Azure Active Directory domain. So there are, you know, security ACLs at the application level that are keeping all the data isolated across tenants, and each individual mailbox, of course, has its own end-user ACL that's applied to it. So there are, you know, many, many layers of protection there when it comes to securing the data.
That sounds great. I don't know how to put this. You know, it sounds like a lot of firms and a lot of companies might have trouble really putting together that much security on their own. But when you put it in the cloud like this, you get sort of the scales of economy and 24/7 coverage and all that sort of stuff. So I have to admit, having learned more about the security, I find it even more attractive and less of a detractor from moving to the cloud with this. So that's all good news. And, you know, this is the part I think is the best, really, is the ease of administration. You know, so you no longer have to worry about applying service packs, patches, you know, making sure you're not running out of space, doing upgrades, you know, all those sorts of things. I don't know what else there is to add to that other than, for me, you know, when I think about doing a project like this, that's one of the pieces where I think this is going to be great, because this is just a lot less headache and hassle for me and late nights in the data center. So would you agree with all that? Is that pretty accurate?
Yep, definitely summed it up. I mean, the way I net it out when I talk to customers is that Exchange Online really frees up your administrators to focus on service administration, right? So they're onboarding new users, they're doing the legal hold work we talked about, that kind of thing. They're doing the work that brings business benefit, and they're relieved of the obligation to do things like, hey, the SAN's going to run out of space, we need to go through a procurement process and an installation and a migration and all that kind of stuff. They don't have to worry about that anymore. Like you said, patching, it relieves them of that. So it really puts them on the high value tasks.
Well, and the other freedom I think you get from this is for the backup guys. You know, I think in most of our organizations, email backups are probably the biggest single chunk of data type. You know, we produce a lot of documents, but increasingly email is the biggest chunk of data. And to not have to worry about making sure you back that up in the appropriate window every night, that frees up a tremendous amount of resources and headache as well. So,
yeah, I didn't touch on it before when we were talking about the storage fabric, but so each piece of mail that comes in the data into our data center is going to be written to disk several times. So, you know, we have redundancy within the data center, and then we have our data centers organized in pairs. So we'll also then take that data and we'll replicate it to the paired data center. So in the event of a disaster at the primary data center, we can still provide your company access to your email when we fail you over to the other data center. So all of that replication and everything is going on in real time, 24/7 at all times.
Yeah, and I think, I think our audience probably figured this out already. But the other piece of that is if my data center goes down, I can still take a device and go to a Starbucks or wherever and pick up my email without any disruption. And increasingly, document management systems are, I think, neck and neck with email as far as the critical applications for a firm and whatever the billing system is, too. I wouldn't want to underestimate that. but here's one where you just kind of, it just, the headache goes away and you're online all the time. Well, what's it look like then if, you know, now you've sold management on it and you're ready to move to the cloud? What kind of, give us some possible scenarios of how that might look when I say, okay, I have 500 mailboxes, I'm ready to go. How do I start?
There are really kind of three different approaches that we support. For the 500 mailbox scenario, that's in an area that we would consider a small size. In that case, you could do a cutover migration. Then for larger organizations or those that might be running older versions of Exchange on-premise, like Exchange 2003 or 2007, the next alternative would be what we call a staged migration. So the difference between cutover and staged is just how quickly individual mailboxes are moved over. So with a cutover migration, you'll replicate all the mailboxes and then you'll, you know, change your MX records and cut over all at one time. With a staged migration, you're actually going to have mail flow go from the online environment back into the on-premise environment, and you're going to have a mix of some mailboxes that had been, you know, to move a few at a time into the online environment, and, you know, gradually over the course of several weeks or months, you'll migrate mailboxes until you reach a point where you've got all the mailboxes in the cloud. And then the last option is what we call a hybrid migration. And that's kind of like a stage migration that goes on indefinitely. So with a hybrid configuration, the thought is that there'll always be some small subset of mailboxes that you keep on-premise servers. I want to highlight and mention hybrid for this audience just in the context of addressing regional or geographic data storage constraints. At present, one of the limitations of Exchange Online is that we can only stand up and provide mailbox services for a given Office 365 tenant within a single data center region. And so what that means is if your headquarters address is in the U.S., you're going to get an Office 365 tenant in, provisioned inside of one of our U.S. data centers. But if you have offices in, overseas, you may or may not, for, legal or regulatory reasons, may not be able to move those mailboxes into a U.S.-based data center. Well, in that case, the hybrid scenario might make good sense for you if, the bulk of your majority of your users are in the U.S. So you, what you'll do is you'll leave an Exchange server on-premise in your rest of world locations, and then you'll just migrate all of your U.S. users to Exchange Online in the U.S.
That sounds like a good workaround for that.
Yeah, that is what it is. It's kind of a stopgap. I think eventually, Microsoft would like to be able to address those regional concerns directly, but this is what we have today.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one on not just for email, but I mean to deal mm-hmm. with. That particular problem of regulations that vary by country and privacy concerns and so on. So one of the other questions or one of the other things I see discussed on a fairly frequent basis on the Yoda listservs is Mimecast and just sort of an online archiving product. And they also do some mail filtering, spam filtering, those sorts of things. Can I use that in conjunction with an online Office 365 Exchange Online, or do I have to discard that, or do I have no need for that anymore because, I have these big mailboxes with unlimited archives? But
right.
And I guess one other question around all of that is if, for example, I said I don't need Mimecast anymore, is there a migration path, I guess, to take all that sort of Mimecast archived email and get it back into a single repository?
So let's break apart. I'll talk about the filtering aspect separately from the archiving aspect. So let's talk first about filtering. In fact, with filtering, we don't allow you to filter ahead of Exchange Online. We require you to use Exchange Online protection filtering. Now, the reasons for that are because of the way blacklisting works and that kind of stuff. So we don't want two filtering products chained together because it's possible that one could get the other one blacklisted. So it's bad for us. It's bad for the other vendor. So we require customers to only use one filtering product. And if you're in Exchange Online, you're going to use Exchange Online protection. One other point I want to make about Exchange Online protection is that in that hybrid scenario that I talked about, you would be using only Exchange Online protection there. If you were completely on premises and you weren't going to use the, mail flow and mailbox functionality of Exchange Online protection, you can still use Exchange Online protection by itself with your on-premise Exchange infrastructure. And I definitely encourage customers to think about that as, the toe in the water first step. I've got a number of customers who use Exchange Online protection. They migrated away from other email filtering products and have grown to be happy with our solution. We've added a lot of capabilities to that solution over the last few years in order to be very competitive with other offerings in the market. And we've got some new advanced capabilities that are coming soon, what we call advanced threat protection capabilities. And these will be things where we can do constrained detonation of attachments. In other words, we'll open up an attachment in a sandbox in our cloud and make sure that it's not carrying a virus payload. We can do link redirection and link filtering. So, that's a big problem with phishing attacks, right? They present a very legitimate looking email, but there's an embedded link that they're trying to trick you into clicking that takes you to a nefarious site. We can rewrite and redirect all the links on the inbound messages so that those links first come to a secure Microsoft server, and then we will follow the link and make sure that it's not pointing to something that's an unhealthy site. So we protect you from virus infections that way. So those are some things that are coming to the service. So that's filtering. Let's switch back then and talk about archive. So
before before we do that, let me put in a plug for the filtering. I've used it for a number of years, and I've used other solutions as well. And I would say it's as good as or better than any of the other spam filtering products on the market. We don't get a ton of spam in. You know, sometimes it slips past or it's over-inclusive, and I think it works great. So, and I can say that with a couple of years' experience, and I'm happy to put in a plug for that. So the sandbox, that sounds great too. And but anyways, I interrupted. Please continue.
No worries. That's the kind of interruption I'll take all day, so thanks a lot. So archiving. From a business perspective, it would be kind of foolish throwing money out the window to maintain a separate archiving solution when archiving is included within the cost of the subscription that you pay for Exchange Online. So I definitely encourage all my customers to think about changing their archive policies. Now, there are some constraints and limitations with regard to how some existing archiving products work. This gets into an area that I'm not really an expert in, but so I want to caution what I'm about to say, but I believe that products that leveraged server-side journaling are not going to work with Exchange Online. That's something I'd have to research for sure to find out. But you can leave existing mail in the legacy archive system and then archive new mail in Exchange Online going forward. That's an approach that some customers take. It may be a cost-effective and good enough approach. And then others will actually go through an exercise to migrate their archives over into Exchange Online. And, you know, that's a kind of a cost-benefit trade-off because it definitely does incur time and effort, but there might be a benefit in terms of the infrastructure that you can retire and the licensing costs that you can discontinue by completely vacating the old archiving solution. So there are some decisions to be made there, but definitely I encourage customers to think about at least using Exchange Online archiving on the go-forward basis.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the whole reason I think the Mindcast type archiving products took off a few years back was because the growth, the amount of data, and they couldn't keep buying new SANs, and so it would only make sense to get rid of that at the same time. So,
right.
Okay, let's talk. You know, we talked some about security, and you talked about the Compliance Center. The notes we were tossing back and forth before this call, we talked, you know, there's some reference in here to data loss prevention, governance and compliance, and information rights management. And before we wrapped up, I wanted to know, you know, did you want to expand on any of those further, or do you feel like we covered that earlier?
There are a couple things that I'll expand on. These topics in and of themselves can get pretty deep, so we're going to have links published with the podcast that I'll encourage folks to look at. Specifically, there was an entire track at the Microsoft Ignite conference that took place early May of 2015, where there were a number of demonstrations of all of the compliance-related functionality that's included in Exchange Online. So, you know, they'll do a much better in-depth job than I'm going to do here. But, you know, some of the highlights that I'll call out is we do have rule-based loss prevention capabilities. So this manifests itself to the end user as policy tips. Transport rules can identify if a piece of mail includes, you know, sensitive information relative to various standardized formats. So you see a credit card number, or we see a social security number. If you have loss prevention rules turned on for those, your end users will get a policy tip before they even send the mail. So it's a great kind of just-in-time education for customers, for your end users, right? You probably have written policies that say, hey, don't send this kind of message or this kind of data in an email message. But at the point of infraction, they're not remembering the policy. They're just trying to get their job done. This is a way to protect your organization and limit the organization's liability by helping the user do the right thing. So it's a great feature. And then you can use the data loss prevention rules in combination with information rights management. Say there's a justified business need where a certain type of sensitive information needs to be transferred from somebody in your organization to somebody outside your organization. You can configure a rule that says, I will allow it, but I will apply rights management to the item before it leaves. And what that does is it applies encryption to the document, to the attachments in the message, and then when the recipient gets that, they're going to have to log in, prove their identity, and you'll be able to verify their access, and you'll be able to log that the document was accessed by that individual. So there's auditing that comes along as a benefit of that capability as well. So I'll wrap up by saying, you know, go watch the videos and see this stuff, how it operates. Definitely a big business value there as well, included right in the service, no extra fees.
Wow, that's great. I wasn't aware of that, so I will watch those videos. That sounds like a really, you know, I could imagine an end user saying, hey, you know, I was trying to send out these social security numbers, and I think I have a virus. Something popped up and said I wasn't allowed to do that. But that really does look valuable. I know that that's something a lot of organizations struggle with, where certain kinds of data, for years, that's how people operated, and now it's not okay to email that stuff around. That there's people have woken up to the dangers of doing that, and it's great that now there's a tool just right there built into Exchange to help mitigate that risk. So. Well, we've been on here for a little bit, and Larry, I want to thank you again for taking time to do these podcasts. I think this is great information, and I like TechNet articles, but I think these kind of conversations are a little bit easier to digest and a little bit easier to follow. So I appreciate you taking time to do it. And with that, we look forward to our next call. And if you have other ideas, don't hesitate to post them on right there by the podcast about the other kind of things you'd like us to talk about. And have a great day. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, Jim.